I was talking about Uchiyama Roshi and his practice of remembering Kanzeon. And I was quoting a little bit the beginning of the Kanan-gyo, the 25th chapter of the Lotus Sutra. And it reminded me that every year at Thanksgiving at Green Gulch, we would chant that sutra. It was the only time of the year that we would chant it, and every year we chanted it on Thanksgiving. We would go to the Zendo, we would have our noon service, which would consist of bowing and chanting the Kanan-gyo Sutra. And then we would go back into the dining room and have our big feast. And lots of people would come for Thanksgiving. And it was very exciting and fun. And I'm not sure now exactly what we thought was the connection between the Kanan-gyo and Thanksgiving, but we must have had something in mind. Because, I mean, obviously, Dogen did not celebrate Thanksgiving. Or I don't think anybody in Japan ever did. Maybe they do now, I don't know. But there's another text that we know much better than that one that's called the Kanan-gyo. And our text that we know well is also often referred to as the Kanan-gyo, the 10-line Kanzeon Sutra, which is not a sutra, really. It's only 10 lines long. It's a kind of a mantra or dharani. And Uchiyama Roshi also speaks about this in his book. And he tells us that this little mantra was written not in India, but in China by monks in the Nirvana school, which was one of the early Chinese schools, somewhere between the 5th and the 7th centuries, and that the text was adopted by the Tiantai school in China, which was transported to Japan and became the Tendai school. And Tim told us the other day that's the school that was dominant in Japan when Dogen was a boy, and he ordained in that school. And no doubt, as a young monk, chanted the Kanan-gyo, and that's why we chant it. And as you know, the title that we use for that text is the Enmei Jiku Kanan-gyo, which roughly translates as the 10-verse Kanan Sutra for protecting life. But I think a translation that is just as good, just as accurate, but I think better, is the Endless Dimension 10-line Kanan Sutra. The Endless Dimension 10-line Kanan Sutra. So in his book, Uchiyama Roshi gives his version of the text, and this is the English from his version, which was translated by Howard Lazzarini and Shohaku Okamura. And this is what we've been chanting all these years, in case you haven't seen a translation of it, because we never chant it in English. I take refuge in the Bodhisattva Kanzeon. We have a causal connection with Buddha. We have a karmic affinity with Buddha. We have an affinity with Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha. Permanent, blissful, self, undefiled. Every morning, our thoughts are of Kanzeon. Every evening, our thoughts are of Kanzeon. Thoughts continuously arising from life. Thoughts not separated from life. That's his version of what those 10 Japanese lines say. So the first line in Japanese is Kanzeon Namu Butsu. And actually, that doesn't mean we pay homage to Kanzeon. Literally, it seems to mean Kanzeon, like we're addressing Kanzeon. Kanzeon, we pay homage to Buddha. We revere Buddha. That's what it actually says. And I guess the idea is that Buddha, or awakening itself, which we use the word Buddha to denote, which isn't really a person or a something or a state of mind or anything like that, but probably maybe is just being itself, which is inherently awake and beautiful, before we mess it up with our attachments and our confusion and all our bright ideas. The Buddha himself or herself stands behind everything, is everything. So that when we chant Kanzeon and invoke the loving Bodhisattva, we call Kanzeon, who loves the world so much and hears all the sounds of the world, which are the sounds of the suffering of the world. As we do that, of course, we are really invoking the Buddha, the true self of Kanzeon, and the true self of you and of me and of the whole world and everything. So we're kind of saying, Kanzeon, please come around and help us invoke Buddha. Because invoking Buddha is the beginning of everything. The invocation of Buddha is kind of like the all-purpose magic spell that enables everything to happen. So that's what we do at the beginning of the Kanzeon Sutra. Before we say another word, we say, Kanzeon, we invoke, we revere, we identify with, we embrace Buddha. And now the sutra can begin. And then it says, we have a causal connection with Buddha, we have a karmic affinity with Buddha, we have an affinity with Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha. And in his commentary on this, Uchiyama Roshi says that the Nirvana school and the Tendai school had a kind of a complicated teaching about various causal connections that sentient beings have with the Buddha, various different kinds of causal connections. And we have a similar idea also in Soto Zen that we kind of bring down to one phrase, which is the one great causal condition. The one great causal condition. That's the phrase that we use. And it's a wonderful phrase that is not that hard to understand, but it's actually pretty hard to see it and live it and realize it all the time in our lives. And it's not that you have to figure out, you know, what it means or something like that, but rather, usually it happens if you practice for a long time. It just becomes natural to you, whether you know the phrase or not, it doesn't matter. The feeling that that phrase is evoking becomes normal to you, natural to you. And what it means is that the one great causal condition of this whole colorful world, this whole beautiful, elegant, and messy world with all its troubles, the one great causal condition of all of this is the compassion of the Buddha. This is all just the unfolding of the compassion of the Buddha. The world and everything in it and about it, including the suffering and the tragedy, exists because of Buddha's great love for beings and Buddha's profound wish that all beings awaken to happiness and freedom. And whatever struggles we have, and whatever struggles the world has, are all for this purpose. That is the meaning of it all. So that's not hard to understand, right? That's a pretty simple idea. Much harder, of course, to realize and feel this at the heart of one's own suffering and the heart of the suffering of the world. That's harder. But we can do it. We can see it that way, and we can live our lives in the seeing of it that way. And I think that this teaching is almost the same thing as what they have in Judaism, Christianity, probably Islam too, when they spend so much time praising God. So many prayers, you know, are praising God. And you could think, well, that's really odd. You know, why would you spend so much time praising God? You'd think that God, being perfect and complete, wouldn't care about being praised, you know, like would be even maybe annoying to God. But no, there's so many prayers that are praising God all the time. Maybe praising God is the main prayer. The rest of it is sort of ancillary. The main thing is you praise God. Why is that? Now that I think of it, maybe there is a connection between the Kanangyo and Thanksgiving, because Thanksgiving is that, right? It's giving thanks to and praising God for this world. Thank you for this world, for the sunlight that shines on the fields and gives us the harvest that we're eating now. You are so great, God, that you can do this. And we are grateful for it. Now that we're about to eat this food, we remember where it comes from. We say that too. We express our gratitude. And that's, in a way, what we're doing when we chant the Kanzeon Sutra. And when you praise God, I mean, I think that, I don't know what God thinks about it, but definitely it's good for us, right? Because when we praise God, when we invoke Kanzeon, it reminds us, because we forget, that nothing belongs to us. We have created virtually nothing. Everything has been given. We don't have to be alive. We could be dead, or maybe never even born in the first place. And if we were alive, we don't have to be alive on such a nice planet. You know? Perfect. Some people think they can be alive on Mars. I'm not into that. I like being alive on the Earth because it's so nice. Isn't it? The sun is perfect because when it's warm on my skin, I'm very happy. My skin seems to be made for that. So we don't have to be alive on a planet with such nice sunlight and such beautiful plants that look so nice, the trees, the flowers. Plus, we can eat them and nourish ourselves and be strong. None of this was invented in Silicon Valley. None of it. Smart as they are in Silicon Valley, none of this was invented there. It has all been given for no reason that anyone can fathom. And if we forget that it all has been freely given by a compassionate God or by a compassionate Buddha, or if we don't like to say it that way, we could say freely given by reality itself, freely given by the cosmos. If we forget that it's all been given, and we think we're the smart ones, we're going to lose our way. We're going to lose our way. There are no rights and entitlements. Everything is a gift. And gratefulness is the essence of the spiritual life. Maybe if I'm suffering right now, it's tough, but if I were dead, I wouldn't be suffering. And on the whole, I'm glad I am alive and have been alive. I'm glad that I have been able to know life and to know what love is and to know the feeling of belonging to everyone. And even if along with that goes my suffering right now, well, it's not that bad. It will pass. And I am connected to Buddha, Dharma, Sangha. I have affinity with Buddha, Dharma, Sangha in the very suffering maybe especially then. And Buddha Dharma Sangha isn't someone or something outside my mind and heart and life, outside my suffering. It is my mind, my heart, my life. Maybe you were surprised by the next line that says, permanent, blissful, self, and undefiled. Which I guess are words to describe Kanzeon and Buddha Dharma Sangha. And it seems surprising because didn't the Buddha become like world famous for saying impermanence, suffering, non-self? We've been scratching our heads over non-self for quite a long time around here. Didn't he say impermanence, suffering, non-self, delusion? But here it seems to say the opposite. To many of us, this comes as no surprise because we've been listening to Dogen for a long time, so we're not surprised when things turn out to be the opposite of the way they seem. Someone said to me the other day, I think I'm beginning to get it. We had a long, my wife Kathy did a seminar for 6 weeks on verses from the middle, the teachings of Nagarjuna's verses on the emptiness teachings. And they said, I think I'm beginning to get it. I think I'm beginning to understand that form and emptiness are the opposite of one another, but that you need the other. Each one needs the other. Is that it? And I said, well, almost. Because the Heart Sutra doesn't say form is the opposite of emptiness, does it? It says form is emptiness. Emptiness is form. They're not opposites. They don't need each other. They are each other. They're not two different things, two different states. They're just two different words. But actually, it's more than that. Because we also say, it doesn't say in the Heart Sutra, but we also say, form is form. Emptiness is emptiness. That's also true. Sometimes we completely abandon form as emptiness, and it's just form, only form. When the world appears before us with urgency, and we respond with full force, and full attention. Form is form. And sometimes there's no world at all. Just space. And there's nothing to say, nothing to do, and nothing to think. And we just open our arms to the ineffable. And sometimes it's neither one of those two, or both at the same time, or neither one. Someone asked Yunmun. It's getting very confusing. There is a Yunyan, but this is not him. This is Yunmun. Someone asked Yunmun, what is the teaching of a lifetime? And Yunmun said, an appropriate response. Impermanence, suffering, non-self, and delusion is definitely Buddhist doctrine. And when you contemplate them, you see how true those are. So it's not that it's not true. It's just that we can't get stuck on anything. Because as soon as we get stuck on something, that thing that's true becomes false. When we're stuck on something, that thing immediately becomes something else. And we realize that the fundamental meaning of impermanent suffering, non-self, and delusion is permanence, bliss, self, and purity. From the side of the Buddha and Kanzeon, This is how impermanent suffering, non-self, and delusion looks. It looks perfect, blissful, eternal, and a full expression of true self. When we chant the 10-line Kanangyo, we are reminding ourselves of this, that the disaster that we are in the midst of, maybe as we're calling out to Kanzeon, is already, in the moment of the calling out, peace, compassion. It's already bliss and perfection in the moment of the calling out. Because in the calling out, Kanzeon is already there. And all that Kanzeon brings is present in the very calling out. We open up the hand of thought and live this moment. And we're okay. The last lines. Every morning our thoughts are of Kanzeon. Every evening our thoughts are of Kanzeon. Thoughts continuously arising from life. Thoughts not separated from life. Now, of course, we might not be thinking of Kanzeon all the time. But the lines don't mean that we're thinking of Kanzeon in the morning and we're thinking of Kanzeon in the evening, although they seem to say that. They mean that all our thoughts all the time are always already thoughts of Kanzeon. Only we forgot that. And we got fooled into thinking that the thoughts were ours, our private creations, and that they are about something other than Kanzeon. But our thoughts, perceptions, impulses, consciousness are not ours. They're not our private affair. And they're never, ever about what they seem to be about. They are given, just as everything is given. When you are sitting in Zazen and a thought arises in your mind, no matter how painful, how small, or how exalted, it can only be that all the causes and conditions of the universe have conspired to produce that very thought in your very mind in that very moment. What other possibilities are there, really? Of course that thought is there right now. It's awesome that it's there. It is awesome that you have a human mind, and a particular human mind, that's going to produce exactly this thought in this moment. It is truly awesome. Whatever the thought is, deluded or enlightened. And we are so used to making thoughts into self. And then, because self is the most interesting thing in the world, right? There's nothing more interesting than me, right? I'm chasing my thoughts. And I forgot to notice what they really are. Every thought, perception, impulse, every moment of consciousness is Kanzeon all the time. Thoughts continuously arising from life, thoughts not separated from life. These lines are most often translated, that's a little unusual translation. Most often the lines are translated something like, thought after thought arises from mind, thought after thought not separate from mind. And that is a more accurate translation of the Sanskrit, or the Chinese words. But it might actually be better, even though it's not as literally accurate, to translate mind as life. Because if you say mind around here, it always sounds mental. In our languages, in our traditions, mind is mental. But in Buddhism, mind is not mental. Mind is all of reality. And reality is not an abstraction. Reality is alive. Everything is alive. Even stones are alive. Space is alive. And all of that is mind. So actually, it's pretty good to translate it as life. Slightly misleading because it makes it sound like it's not death. But never mind. When the line says thoughts, it doesn't just mean thoughts. Since everything we experience, without exception, including our body, our perceptions, our emotions, is necessarily mediated through consciousness. The word thought here means everything we experience, our whole life. So the lines are a kind of a tautology. They're saying all our life, every detail of our life, every thought, every experience, every perception is nothing but life. All of life, all of the time. So mind is life. But also, I was thinking today, mind is also space. I've been thinking about space today. Space. What is that exactly? Space. It's a funny thing, space. It's by definition, it's sort of like nothing, right? Empty space, which you fill up with stuff. Space is empty, right? If you fill it up with stuff, you can't say there's space there. Oh, the room had a lot of space in it, but now it's very crowded in here, not much space. But of course, you don't fill up space. The space, I guess, is still there, right? Even if you fill it up. So it's not clear what space is or isn't. But it seems like there can't be no space. If there wasn't any space, there couldn't be things to take up the space. So you have to have space, even though maybe it's not anything. And actually, as we now know for sure, even the things themselves that fill up the space are themselves full of space. On a micromolecular level, you know, when they try to find out, like, the thing that's not space, it turns out to be space too. They're still trying to figure it out. Maybe they will. But we don't know what space is, you know? It's funny. Like, this thing that everything depends on, we don't know what it is, really. I mean, believe me, people have thought about this. You can rest assured, some people think that space is something, some kind of non-material thing, absolute thing, like Newtonian space. You know, that was Newton thought there was space. It was something. But other people say, no, space isn't anything. What it is, it's the relation between things. So the space between things is defined by the relationship between things, and it's the space that enables the relationship. We need the space to be in relation to one another. Think about that. I think that's true, you know? And it's a wonderful practice, just the kind of practice that my old teacher used to love to talk about, the practice of looking at, seeing with your eyes, kind of practicing seeing the space between things rather than the things. Because we're very conditioned to see the things, right? Our whole apparatus works to see the things. But what if you intentionally tried to see the space between things? You would see that the space between things is really charged with life, as much as the things are charged with life. And that the space really is a living connector of us. But some people think that space isn't anything at all in the world, that space is in our minds. And this is Kant's famous world revolutionary idea. He said that space is like a transcendental ideal, a framework imposed by the mind to organize sensory experience. So it's not a property out there in the world. It's a condition of our mind that makes experience possible. That's what space is, Kant thought. A very profound thought, really. Or maybe the distinction between the mind and what's outside the mind is a spurious distinction. Certainly, mind and outside of mind seem different, and we wouldn't be able to live in the world as normal people if we didn't conventionally accept that difference. But are they really different in the end? Or are they the same? And when you think about it, is there a difference between difference and sameness? Or are those just words that we use to confuse ourselves? I shall stop going down that path right now. Not going any further than that. I'm thinking about this because I'm thinking today that isn't Zazen like creating space? Now, you can't create space. Space is already there. And I don't think there could be more space or less space. But somehow, don't you feel that when you do Zazen, we're in the, what is it, the second day of Sesshin? No. Fifth?
Nobody knows.
Anyway, after a little while, in Sesshin, you have the feeling that there's more space. At least I have that feeling. There's more space. Things seem more spacious than they did before. The same thing that didn't feel very spacious at all feels more spacious in Sesshin. Maybe you have some suffering, some very big suffering. And one of the things that's so painful about that suffering is there's no space. Suffering can feel very confining. Nobody else is suffering, but you're suffering. The suffering is crowded into you, and you are very alone in it. And it's almost like squeezing you. And that's what's really, really terrible about it. That's what makes it almost unbearable. But when you sit for a while, and when you have sat for a while, and when sitting is a part of your life and a part of what you do and a part of how you understand your life, maybe sometimes you can feel some spaciousness. And when you feel spaciousness, even if the suffering is very great, it's different because there's a big space around it. There's a wide field. And the suffering is held in that space. Maybe that space is Kanzeon's love. And that makes the suffering bearable. And maybe even we can see some beauty in it. And I say that especially here because one of the things that is so lovely about our session at Samish is that there's so much space here. Even the Zendo is huge, right? How much, but we don't need all this space. It's very spacious in this Zendo. It's like the giant Zendos in Japan that are also very big. Some of them. Ceilings. So high. But especially when you go outside, the feeling that you have, at least I have this feeling, there's so much space. The big sky, the big open expanse of the lawn. The long, beautiful walk that takes forever between the dining room and the Zendo and the Zendo and the dining room. I think that's the best part of Sesshin. The walking back and forth and back and forth. And when my mind goes to Samish Sesshin, that's what I think of. The walking back and forth. All of us in silence with all that space around us and all the little animals scurrying this way and that way, and all the sounds that fill up the space. And maybe sometimes, like yesterday, you see a bald eagle floating around overhead, round and round, slowly, day after day, back and forth, back and forth, back and forth. And the sky, big enough to contain whatever is inside of you. It's like the sky feels what you feel, and you feel what the sky feels. It's the same thing inside of you and the sky. The whole earth and the whole sky feeling what you feel, and you feeling what it feels. I've always marveled that when the Chinese tried to translate the Sanskrit word for emptiness, they couldn't find a word. I don't know Chinese. Is it possible that there's no Chinese word for emptiness? Shunyata is the word in Sanskrit, and emptiness in English is a fair translation of that word. But in Chinese, to translate that word, they used the character for sky. In Chinese, that's what emptiness is, the open sky. That's actually the word for emptiness in Chinese. When we were down at Tassajara recently, Kathy and I, we were studying the record of the Pang family. Maybe some of you know that old Zen text. Very unusual, because it's the record of the sayings and doings of Layman Pang and his family, his wife and his daughter and son. And they all practice Zen together closely and intimately. And although they had lots of encounters with monastic Zen teachers, they themselves were householders. Although they were fully awakened, they never became formal Zen ordained people, so they were never formal teachers. And that's what makes the text unusual, because almost all the records of Zen teachers are the records of formal teachers, monastic ordained teachers. And so one of the most striking parts of the Pang text, and it's very famous, I'm sure you've heard it before, is the death of them. So I'll quote you from the text. The layman was about to die. He spoke to Ling Zhao, his daughter, saying, "Go out and see how high the sun is. And when it's noon, come back and tell me. It doesn't say this, but I guess the idea is, I'm going to die at noon. Let me know when it's time. So she went out, and she came back in, and she said, well, it's noon, but there's an eclipse. Darn, you know, he couldn't die. So he went out to make sure that there was an eclipse. And when he went outside, Ling Zhao went into her father's chair, put her hands in Gasho, and passed away. And then the layman coming back in and noticing that his daughter had perished said, my daughter has beat me to it. And he postponed his going for 7 days. After 7 days, Mr. Yu came to inquire how he was, and the layman put his hand on Mr. Yu's knee, gazed at him intently for a long time, and said, I beg you just to regard as empty all that is existent, and to beware of taking as real all that is non-existent. Fare you well in the world. All is like shadows and echoes. And as his words ended, a strange fragrance filled the room, and he sat upright and began to do zazen. Mr. Yu hastily called to him, but he had already passed on the long journey. Then a messenger was sent to report the news to his wife. And when she heard all this, she said, that stupid girl and that ignorant old Chinaman have left without my consent. How unbearable. She then went out to the fields where her son was hoeing and told this to him. Mr. Pang and Ling Zhao are both gone. He put down his hoe and he said, Sa! And died standing up. And his mother said, stupid boy, you are so foolish. Sometime afterward, Mrs. Pang visited her friends throughout the countryside to say goodbye, and then disappeared. All traces of her were entirely lost. No one knows where she is today. So that's the story of how the Pang family perished. It reminds me a little bit of the famous story of Dongshan's death, which also you probably know. When he was ready to die, he told the monks that the time had come, got all dressed up, he sat in zazen all ready to go. But the monks were so full of grief and lamentation that he said, no, I'll have to wait, I guess, for 7 days. So you have a chance to think it over. So to keep them busy for the week, he had them prepare a great banquet, which he called the Great Delusion Banquet. And he himself attended the banquet, and he said, okay, this time don't make such a big fuss. And then he went back to his room and immediately perished. In our time, Suzuki Roshi got cancer and died a more or less ordinary death on the first day of Sesshin, December 4th, 1971. And our teacher Sojin also died a more or less ordinary death from kind of the same cancer that Suzuki Roshi had on January 7th, 2021, two? A few years ago, 21. But traditionally, the stories of Layman Pong's death and Dongshan's death are more typical. So what are these stories trying to teach us? Not, I think, that we're supposed to be casual about death, although it's not forbidden to have a little sense of humor about it. But for sure, when we lose someone that we love, especially someone close to us, someone in our family, we grieve. And sometimes the grief is very strong. We feel desolate for a long time. And nothing that we do or think can help us to remove the desolation. We just have to go through it. And we hope we'll have some companionship, some support, some help. And yet, at the same time, we are taught in the Buddha Dharma that birth and death is one flow, one great continuity, and that nothing dies and nothing is ever born. Life is space, life is spacious, life is gracious, and we are born to live and die. It's okay. It's sad when someone we love dies, especially when it seems as if it's not the time for them to die. But when it's time to die, as it was in those stories, it's good to die. Death is not what we think it is, whatever we think it is. How could death be what we think it is? We are here in this life for a reason, and all of us have a place in this life. All of us have something we are here to do, and we are all doing it as well as we can, as well as we have been given to do it. All the way up to the end, we are doing that. And then when it's time, we go forth on the long journey, and it's a good journey. Actually, we go and we don't go. Because those who are still alive not only remember us and keep us alive in their thoughts and memories and words, but they are us, and we are them. And they really do keep us alive as long as they are alive. And when they are no longer alive, other people keep them alive. And in this human way, we share life, generation after generation after generation, and nothing is ever lost. It is always carried on. And it all turns and turns in the wide, open spaces of our living right now. Thank you for understanding so beautifully what I have said. May our intention equally extend to every being and place with the true merit of Buddha.